thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to talk about birds and bird migration with our guest, Bill Volkert. Always fun to have Bill come by. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for 50 years. He's written some books and has led many bird-watching tours. And so I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. What would you like to know about attracting birds to your yard? What questions do you have about spring migration, perhaps? Join the conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email and or a photo to ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you've got a nice bird photo you want to share, or maybe you're wondering what that bird is. ideas@wpr.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always fun to be here.
This is your 50th year of watching and studying birds. How many species have you seen?
It is just shy of 4,000 species in all of our travels, which is just under half, well under half, because we estimate about 10,500 birds in the world. And what I mean by estimate is I think we've identified and probably even photographed every bird on the planet, but there's not complete disagreement among the scientists exactly what constitutes a species. So different classification systems give different numbers to all the variety of things that are on the planet.
Yeah.
Wherever you go, you can find birds, and that's the fun thing about watching them. It's probably, to me, the most visible and also the most accessible aspect of nature. Birds are everywhere, and they certainly have their appeal and their allure.
Yeah, they sure do. I'm wondering, what is there a bird that you are hoping to find that you haven't found yet?
The next one. There's just so many interesting ones out there, and you know I'll never have enough time and money to see them all. But that really isn't the game, I guess, to see every bird out there. I certainly enjoy the variety, and I love exploring new places. And birds to me is certainly one of the major highlights of any place. And as I've been saying for a long time, if you follow birds, no matter where you go, they're going to take you to the most beautiful places in the country. But it's that chance to be able to see birds in the natural setting. So it is not just the sight of the bird or a check on a list, but that experience of actually watching it within its natural environment and kind of getting a bit of a window into that natural world, that corner of the planet.
Yeah. Well, I know you just got back from a birding tour to Nicaragua. I spent some time in Nicaragua, too. It's a beautiful place, but you've gone there many times. What draws you to that country?
I originally went there 20 years ago, and that was under a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grant to help them develop a national bird conservation education plan. What I found was that as a rather poor and underdeveloped country, there were just great opportunities to help them in their bird conservation and even in ecotourism. And so I've been helping to lead groups there, and I was involved with a number of different conservation projects. There aren't a lot of people working down there, so I just found there was an easy opportunity to do so. And, you know, I've always told people, if you've never really traveled to the tropics, I think the first place to begin is Costa Rica, because they have such a well-developed ecotourism industry. It's really easy to do. But perhaps one of the drawbacks from their success is that they've modernized the country so much that especially the most touristic areas look an awful lot like the United States. What I find about Nicaragua is, in a somewhat underdeveloped state, there's something still authentic about it. There's still something to explore. And it's an area that's not heavily visited, so there's a lot, I think, for people to discover there.
You see any birds, Wisconsin birds, while you were there?
Lots. That was the fun of it. You know, we're all waiting for spring migration for the birds to get here, but that was kind of nice to go down there and see them where they're spending their winter. We had well over a dozen species of Wisconsin warblers and also a number of Western warblers. So birds that nest in the Western United States also winter in Central and Northern parts of South America. So we saw the mix of those, rose-breasted grosbeaks, Actually, one day we had a tree that was just loaded with Baltimore Orioles, and we were sharing that same tree with spot-breasted, orchard, and Altamira Orioles, some of the resident Orioles birds.
So lots there. You know, callers online, maybe we should take some calls. Edie.
Absolutely.
Edie in West Salem. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. Thank you. We've been watching, last year they came over our property, and this year I believe they're trumpet swans.
Trumpeter?
Migrating. Yeah, it's out there. Migrating and heading towards the Mississippi River where we live nearby, just west of it. And at some point, one group, last Sunday I saw six different groups, and the last group, for some reason, tends to stop and fly in a circle for a while. And I'm wondering if you've ever witnessed that or what that would be about. That. And then they just kept going and going in a circle. And last year they were doing it for, it seemed like, 10, 15 minutes. And they looked like they were getting worn out. And then they finally moved on and went the direction they were headed to begin with.
Hmm. Well, what do you think, Bell?
Well, first of all, we have both the tundra and the trumpeter swan in Wisconsin. Trumpeter swans have been reintroduced over the last 25 years or so, and it is a nesting population. It's still a small and somewhat restricted population as far as their distribution in Wisconsin. The big numbers of swans that are just beginning to arrive and we'll be seeing coming through for the next several weeks, that's the tundra swan, formerly called whistling swan. They're coming from the East Coast, stopping here in the Midwest, and then as spring progresses, they'll be moving up into Canada and Alaska for their nesting grounds. So it's an unusual migration because we see them actually coming to Wisconsin from the east rather than the south. And she described this circling behavior. Well, if you're migrating, you're going from point A to B and looking for a stopover site. And I think these are birds that are arriving early where there's still a lot of ice. And I just heard yesterday that report from the Green Bay area, the first swans were just arriving there. Well, a lot of Wisconsin is still frozen over, and as a water bird, you're going to have to search a bit for a suitable resting and feeding area. And I think that's what those birds were doing, is they're just scoping out a possible site and seeing if it was, first of all, suitable for them or even big enough for a large flock like that. And they'll rest here for the next several weeks as birds are coming in. And by the time we get to about mid-April, they'll be taking off.
And Tyler has some calls of the trumpeter swan. Tyler, you got that? There you go.
It's a little harsher, a little more bugled call, where the tundra swan is almost a soft moaning. And you'll actually hear that as they're flying overhead. And very often, I'll hear them before I see them. And so, yeah, trumpeter does refer to that little bit more of a forceful vocalization that they make.
Yeah. Well, Edie, I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Tom in Baraboo. Hi, Tom.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I live up here in Wisconsin River, just outside of Baraboo, up by the Leopold thing. And 2 years ago, we had a bird come through in the spring. I think it was the first week of May. And it's calling. It said, Ricky, 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 just as plain as day, about seven times. And about 10 minutes later, continued doing it. It lasted for a week, and then he disappeared. I've never heard about a bird. I mean, I'm pushing 70 years old, been out here all my life. It's a new one to me, so he must have been somebody traveling through. But I've tried everything to know to find out what he was.
Ricky, Ricky, Ricky. What do you think, Bill?
Oh, boy, we might throw this open to the audience. You know, it's always a bit of a trick that everybody hears or describes it a little different. But it is obviously two notes that he's describing repeated. First one that came to my mind is perhaps tufted titmouse. It's a little more of a sharp whistle. It's described as Peter, Peter. Well, Peter, Ricky, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Ricky to me sounds like it's got a little raspiness at the beginning, though. I guess I'll just leave it for the audience to maybe give us some hints of what
some ideas
may hit them. Yeah. This is obviously why we record bird sounds, because our ability to try to describe these foreign vocalizations like that, it leaves a lot of room for interpretation. By the way, if people are interested in bird sounds, I would strongly recommend downloading the an app that's out there, and that is from Cornell University. This is called Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-N, like the magician, and actually also like the falcon, the Merlin. And they've got a nice field guide and also the vocalizations, a lot of recordings of birds. So if you've got some idea what it might be, you can double-check it there right on your phone.
There you go, Tom. Thank you so much. Don in Iron River, on to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi, good morning. Say, I have a comment and a question. Comment is, I heard my first robin yesterday.
Good for
and
you.
And the question is, hummingbirds travel up to Douglas County, and they're always here within a day or two at my feeder. And how many miles are they able to travel in a day?
That is a really good question. The problem with hummingbirds is that even with some of the latest innovations in our technology for tracking bird movements, they're a little small. Electronics can be made pretty tiny, but they need to have a battery to power it. So we're not able to attach a lot of things onto a hummingbird. The MODIS apparatus is the latest one, and we are putting those on some pretty tiny birds and even large insects. So a hummingbird would be a possible candidate for that. The hard thing, of course, is how do you attach it without encumbering the bird? And hummingbirds are built different from other birds. I can tell you this, when we were down in Nicaragua, we had, I think, 16 species of hummingbirds there and quite a few ruby-throated hummingbirds. Yeah. Of course, they nest all over eastern United States, so hard to say where they came from, whether they were, you know, somewhere far out east, New England, or if that was a Wisconsin bird. But, yeah, they are going all the way down to the tropics, and you are right that right around that first week of May is when they show up again. So we've got, about a month and a half here, a little more than a month's time before we see those arrive again, usually about the same week that the Baltimore Orioles come back. Two pretty obvious birds.
Yeah, and Don mentioned the robin, and I heard one this morning myself. Tyler, you got a robin?
Nice cheery little whistle. Yeah. Actually, if you start listening to robins between the different songs and the call notes they make, they've got a real vocabulary. There's a lot of different vocalizations from them. So a very common bird, but an easy one to study that way, too. They've actually been back for a few weeks, but they're now settling in a little bit more. And those are always the first pioneers that tend to arrive early. So the flocks are building up, and I think they're becoming a little more evident across much of the state at this time of year.
You know, I went out for my morning run or jog, I should say, this morning. I do every morning, but this morning there was no wind. It was calm, and I just started hearing. I mean, there's just the only sounds were birds, and I thought to myself, okay, I'm not going to try to identify all the different birds, but what I am going to do is count the different songs and see how many I can come up with. And I got up to around 15, and then I thought I wasn't sure if I was might be starting to recount the same songs, but there were I had 15 at least. Of course, I was along the lake too, so some ducks and geese got involved in there. But how many birds are we hearing in Wisconsin right now, do you think?
Well, some of the early migrants and also the birds that stuck around for the wintertime are starting to tune up right now. And I think most people will certainly be hearing robins, cardinals, chickadees. They're becoming very vocal this time of year. Nesting is still a ways away, but they are starting to claim some of their territories. And with that, especially nice mornings, are getting a little bit more noisy out there. Also, red-winged blackbirds, they've been back for a good month or so. Anywhere where you got a little bit of a wet spot or an open field, you'll hear them singing out there. So, yeah, it's that time of year that things are tuning up, and it's becoming really kind of that background music for springtime.
Well, our birding expert and on-air producer Courtney Everett says that Ricky sound might have been a Western meadowlark.
Western meadowlark. Yeah, I think of it as a little more of a almost flute-like warbled type of call. Well, let's see what else other people may think, too. Yeah. Western meadowlark also is a bird that is becoming it never was real common in Wisconsin, kind of a specialist for the open fields, but we've seen in the last 25 years quite a decline in the population. Eastern meadowlark also has been declining, but still can be found throughout quite a bit of the state. Wisconsin was always at sort of that eastern edge of the western meadowlark's range.
Our guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator, talking birds with him. Jill Nadeau is our producer. Courtney Everett's our on-air producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking birds and bird migration today with our guest, Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Bill, we got an email from Steve who would like to know some of the best things we can do in our yards and communities to lay out the welcome mat for our migrants. Are there things that should be put off, for example, delayed fertilizer applications? With the current spread of avian flu, should individuals be concerned while feeding birds seed meal, you know, mealworms, seed, fruit for orioles, hummingbirds, and so forth?
Oh, good question. When we set up bird feeding stations, we certainly can attract birds to our backyard, but as we found even with our own pandemic, that concentrating organisms like that can lead to disease spread. So social distancing is sometimes a necessity. I think the best thing we can do is as we monitor some of these diseases, such as salmonella outbreaks, bird flu, other things like that, is just make sure that it's not something that's reported in your area. I don't want to discourage people from not feeding birds. It's something that we can certainly do for our own enjoyment and to become a little more acquainted with birds and having them around the house. But I would say keep your feeding stations up unless there is some real warning. You may remember last year there was some unidentified disease in the eastern states. We never quite figured out what the cause was. And right there, they were looking at the spread of it and telling people to shut down feeders. It never made it as far as Wisconsin. We were sort of on standby. But right now, there's pretty good monitoring of these types of things. So I would say just maintain your bird feeding station until, you know, the warning signals are out there that something may be entering or emerging in our state, our neighborhood. But, yeah, I would certainly say that one of the first things you can do is put up a bird feeder and attract them to your home and enjoy them. They don't really need that food. It's convenient for them. But I think it keeps us attached to birds just by being even aware of them being out there and bringing them a little closer where we can enjoy them and watch them and see the seasonal changes.
Yeah.
If you've got a nice variety of birds coming to your feeder, get yourself a field guide. Learn to identify the birds that you're actually seeing. There's always something different that's going to show up in a backyard. And, of course, right now as we see the ground starting to thaw and get ready for spring planting, I would certainly encourage people to plant native trees and shrubs that attract birds or even plants that provide a hummingbird garden. The question was about lawn fertilizers. It's not just the fertilizers itself, but they oftentimes have the weed killers in them, the 2,4-D, and some of these things can be problematic as contaminants in the environment. And I guess not just reducing the fertilization of your lawn, but maybe reduce lawn altogether. We don't need to mow every square inch that we own. Devote some of that back to nature. Give yourself a little bit of a break. Don't spend so much time at the lawnmower and keep an open area for your own enjoyment and for recreation. And for those far corners of the lot, plant that to something native and make it a little more bird friendly. Also, you may want to consider the window strikes. Once we lure birds to our backyards by making a more friendly bird habitat around our home and putting up our feeders, there's also that hazard that birds do fly into our windows. It's a very non-natural thing for them, and it leads to a lot of deaths of birds. And there's a lot of ways to reduce that, and simply by putting something on the window itself so that birds are aware of it. Some good ideas are available from the American Bird Conservancy if you want to check their website. And last thing I would suggest is with spring coming around, just take a walk to look for birds. Go out and visit a nature center, a park, or a natural area. Take a little bit of a hike. And as COVID restrictions start to lift and we're getting out with other people, maybe take a hike with a naturalist or an expert in the area so they can show you the birds that are there and I help you identify them.
Good points all. Thank you for those comments, Bill. Thomas in Manitowoc has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Thomas.
Hello, Bill and Larry. I was just wondering, I've been watching birds and feeding them for a long time. And this winter, about halfway in, we just had a ton of pine siskins and red poles move in. We've had a few in the past, but this year they came in flocks of 100. Why was there so many and where did they go? Because they've all moved down in the past week. They're gone just like that.
A great observation on your part. Yeah, a lot of people were noticing this year that especially the red poles came in huge numbers and also seemed to come in a little bit later in the season. It wasn't, say, late fall, early winter that they arrived, but as we got deeper into winter, I think a lot of people were not expecting that we'd see quite the big invasion. Pine siskins, they nest in mostly northern Wisconsin, southern Canada. We have had nesting almost anywhere throughout the state in recent years. But these are birds that are heading further north for the most part. And also the red pole is a bird from much farther north in the subarctic regions of Canada. And this is an interesting bird because it's no bigger than our goldfinch. And when there's a good crop, especially of the dwarf birch trees in that subarctic region, which is a winter food for them, they stay there. Even at temperatures at 20, 30 below zero, if there's food, they have no reason to leave. They're incredibly hardy and adapted. But when we get a poor production of food, they bail out and head to different areas. And that was one of those years. They were reporting in Canada that the crop production was rather poor and that we may be expecting an invasion. And sure enough, they came in huge numbers. And as I've been seeing a little bit from the bird watchers around the state, they also have noticed within the last week or so or 10 days, numbers have been thinning out. They're slowly departing from the area. And I hope everybody enjoyed them because they're going to be leaving very soon. And as an invasion like this, it may be a number of years before we ever see big numbers like this again.
Yeah.
So I hope everybody enjoyed it.
Let's hear a red pole. Tyler, you got one? Yeah, there they are.
It's a member of the finch family related to our goldfinch. It's a little more chipping than the goldfinch's song. But, among the flock, you'll hear that kind of talking back and forth, that chattering within the flock. And oftentimes you can hear them overhead as they're flying.
And here's a pine siskin.
That little note at the end of the song, that rising trill, that's what always catches my ear for pine siskin.
Yeah.
That is how I identify them.
It's a very, very, very cool. Well, let's go to Marty in West Salem next. Hi, Marty.
Howdy. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Thank you.
My question is about identifying birds, and I moved out the country about 5 years ago in the woods, and it's been a great experience seeing nature up close. But some friends of ours, we love to kind of one-up each other on the different birds that we have always wanted to see, and two of those birds are the indigo bunting and the scarlet tanager. And over the last couple of years, I've seen a scarlet tanager here and there, usually during the migration periods, and I'm wondering how much they're here, either of those species, and how abundant they are, because it seems to be very rare that we would see either of those two, and I'm still on search for my indigo bunting, and I'll listen and take your question or your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Marty.
Yeah, thanks for the call. A couple of things. Your indigo bunting, a lot of people will notice that when they come back during that first week or 10 days of May, that they'll hit the bird feeders, especially some of the smaller seed, like the millet, cracked corn, things like that. And then they seem to disappear. And I've oftentimes had people ask, so where do they all go? Well, they're just looking for emergency food when they're arriving. And then as natural food becomes available, they move into the woods and into the treetops. The hint for indigo bunting is it's a pretty widespread bird on forest edges around Wisconsin. If you know the song, and here again, I would check the Merlin app and just listen to that song, the quick up and down two notes very rapidly as they're singing. It's a bird that is really quite easily identified by song, and I sometimes will drive country roads with the window open just looking for them that way. The problem is a small bird that's dark blue, you'll see that if he's perched on a feeder or a branch right in front of you, but if he's sitting up above, the light is not reflected off the bird. He's going to be just a little black bird, and he's easy to miss. So that's the first hint there. Scarlet tanager is really a long-distance migrant. They'll go all the way down to South America from Colombia into Peru, and so they've got a long flight. This is a bird that it seems they return to Wisconsin in small numbers. Kind of, it's not big flocking birds, so I usually just see individuals. And that, to me, is just hit and miss. They're also coming back in May, and the trick here is from one year to the next, even a brightly colored bird like that, if we have a slow spring where the birds are arriving, the leaves are still slowly emerging, they're pretty easy to see. If we get a spring where in April it's warming up, the leaves begin to open up very quickly, and then the birds arrive, they've got a lot of camouflage out there. And the problem with scarlet tanager, he's a treetop bird. So once the maple trees are completely open, they're way up above you. And this is, again, where the bird watchers find them more easily by song than they do by sight, even for a brightly colored bird like that. So not entirely uncommon, but it is kind of a hit and miss thing, but always a great chance when you do see them.
Let's get some sounds there. Scarlet tanager, have you got that one, Tyler?
It's back and forth, a little singing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They describe it as a robin with a sore throat. So it has a robin-like reminiscent back and forth little musical call, but it's raspy.
Yeah. What about the indigo bunting? We got that, Tyler?
We talked about paired notes very fast, up and down and up and down.
Yeah.
It tends to be kind of a bubbly song. That's kind of an abbreviated version of the song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very pretty. Let's take another call. We've got Randy and Ripon. Your turn. Hi, Randy. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Good morning. Last year I had a robin build a nest in the back of my garage. And at first I tried to persuade him not to do that. And what I'm wondering, I finally gave up and let him or her have and actually they hatched, they had hatchlings in there. Should I expect that to return? Should I start leaving my door open, or is that not a remote possibility? Do they not come back to the same place?
Well, that's a good question. We do know that birds come back to the same place, especially if they're successful nesting the year before. But of course, for a lot of our songbirds, 3 to 5 years is an average life expectancy. We've had robins live 8 to 12 years or more. I guess like adults living to be over 100 years, it does happen, but there's a relatively fast turnover rate in the population. So you'll see robins in your backyard every year, but the question is it the same individual? Well, we only know that if we have something that's marked, distinguish it from all the others that look like it. If it does come back the same bird, it may seek the same place, as I said, especially if they're successful in raising a family last year. One of the problems is we certainly want to welcome these birds back and give them a chance to nest, but when they're doing so in the wrong place, that could be a little bit of a conflict. And I think the typical case is the robin that nests on the light right by the front door of your house. And then you end up, they can be aggressive as people come and go through the door. You got the droppings all over your stoop. The thing to do there is to try to discourage them very early on when they first start seeking out a place like that where we don't want them, and maybe give them an alternate place. Robins use platforms. So a small shelf somewhere on an outbuilding or something is going to easily give them an alternative site, and where it may not be a conflict with where you're using your front door or something like that.
Randy, thanks again. Rosie in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. I grew up in Colorado, and in addition to your blue bunting story, that is the Colorado state bird. But what I really called about was lots of western meadowlarks out there, and according to my dad, what they're saying is, my name is Pete Williger.
There's a good way to remember it. And this is what we refer to as a mnemonic or mnemonic device. In other words, a little phrase or something to help you remember that rhythm of the call. And bird watchers have just all kinds of these little mnemonics. And I guess some of these work better for some people than they do for others. And everybody should know the old Sam Peabody, 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 or Oh Sweet Canada, 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 which is the white-throated sparrow. Or, of course, Who Cooks for You, Who Cooks for You All, that we use to describe the call of the barred owl. So some of them are very common and easily shared. Others, people make up their own as well. I'm still trying to figure out Ricky Ricky, though.
Well, let's listen to Tyler's got a Western meadowlark. Let's listen.
The trick is always, when you hear that, what is it that stands out to each individual, to you personally, that's going to help you to remember that call when you hear it and identify it with that bird? And that's all part of the learning process. It's literally a foreign language for our ears. And so learning bird songs and calls, it's just one at a time, kind of like trying to learn any other language. It takes practice.
Jane in Oconomowoc has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jane.
Hi. First time listening to the show, and I'm really enjoying it. And I have just started watching birds since that pandemic, really. And I have a European goldfinch. And I don't see them in the Wisconsin bird books at all or anything like that. I have a brother-in-law in Oregon who told me what it was. But do you know much about them? Or I have them here all year. Like, there's one out there right now.
Yeah, well, first of all, they don't really belong here because we have the American goldfinch, and that is, you know, well-named. It's a native to Europe. It's the counterpart. These birds are starting to appear because of escapees and releases from the pet trade. And back within the last 10 years or so, there was a pet store owner down near the southern state line of Wisconsin that was holding on to the European great tit, which is a counterpart to our chickadee, and also the European goldfinch, and release those birds. I do have some trepidation about this because we just don't know if they're ever going to be serious competitors with our native birds. They don't belong here. And the problem is we really won't know what the consequences are, whether they're going to be compatible with our native birds or whether they may be a competitor until the numbers build up, at which point it's too late. So we're messing with nature there, and it only takes one person to cause this kind of an upset or a problem out there. It's certainly a colorful bird, very attractive. My preference would be if I want to see a European goldfinch, I'll go to Europe.
Well, we've got the American goldfinch up. I think Tyler's got it. Let's hear that call. There we go.
He's a chatty little bird,
yeah.
And they're just starting to sing a little bit. They've been calling a lot in the winter flocks, but as they slowly now, as we get into late March and the first couple of weeks of April, you'll notice that the adult males will be changing color from that real dull olive gray winter plumage into the bright lemon yellow of summer with the black forehead. So as they go through those changes, they're also going to start tuning up and singing. These are all, of course, the molt of the bird, the shedding of its feathers and growth of its breeding plumage, and the singing and preparation for the nesting season. It was all part of the hormone changes with the season. And it's just simply a response to the increasing day length. And so those all go hand in hand. And so as we become more colorful, they also become a little bit more vocal.
Jane, thanks a lot for listening, and thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Louise in Dodgeville will give you a chance. Hi, Louise.
Hi, I have a question about whippoorwills. We live on the edge of a state park, and we get a lot of whippoorwills every season, and I record them on my phone. But do you have any recommendations for, like, making a blind of some sort? Or I would like to see one and get a picture of one. So any hints or tips?
That's a real challenge to do so. Yeah, you're lucky to have the whippoorwills by you. It's that west central part of the state that still has a core population, they have been declining across quite a part of the United States. And so we're keeping a close eye on them as we're seeing these populations contract a bit to some of the best habitat. And it seems right now that Dodgeville area out to Wyalusing and going up toward the Eau Claire area is sort of the core area. It's a bird that you just want to drive around a little bit right at an evening and dusk and listen for in that early part of summer. They nest on the ground, and if you look in your book, you'll see their color as well. They look a lot like dried leaves on the forest floor. That's excellent camouflage. They rest during the day, and I actually stumbled across one, I remember years ago, flushing them out of the forest, and I didn't even know they were there until they exploded in front of me. Yeah, to try to get a photo of it, I guess that would be a lifetime challenge. We certainly don't want to disturb the bird if they're nesting either, just because there are right. so few of them. I would say the best thing to do is, just watch a little bit right around dusk to see if you can watch them flying around before it gets too dark. And otherwise, enjoy the music because you're one of the very lucky ones to still hear them out there.
Yeah, I wish I still heard them. Tyler, you got a whippoorwill? Yeah, that's a song you...
Yeah, it gets his name, obviously, from that call. And they can be very persistent. Once they start calling, if you're lucky enough to have them nearby in the evening, they can go on for a long time like that. But it's really that evening music of early summer for those people fortunate to still have them around their area.
Yeah. Thanks, Louise. Appreciate it. Holly and Johnson Creek, your turn.
Hi. We just have a question about bluebird houses and owl houses. Are they supposed to be cleaned out at any time or during the beginning of the season or in the middle, end of the season? Any advice?
Good question. You can clean them out at the end of the nesting season, but a lot of these may have be a winter home for like little deer mouse or something else. So I always clean mine just before the nesting season. I just leave them. Maybe it's just my habit. If you're looking for any hints on bluebirds, I would strongly recommend that you go to the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin website. They've got some great hints about how to construct the boxes, where to place them, how to monitor them, how to distinguish what birds are using them, whether it's bluebirds or tree swallows or even chickadees or wrens, and how to manage the house sparrows to keep them out from not raising a family and have our native birds take advantage of it. So that's the first place you want to start, the BRAW, Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin.
Here you go, Holly. Thank you so much for calling. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, and we're talking birds. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking birds and bird migration on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist Bill Volkert. Great to have him along. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Kyle sent us an email saying he's new to birding and recently came upon the term the Mississippi Flyway when talking about birds in Wisconsin, and wondered if you could talk about what the Mississippi Flyway refers to.
Well, the Mississippi River, being a major north-south corridor, is a big migration route. Birds are following the natural landforms, and so this is the highway. Just follow that river valley from the Gulf Coast right up to the Midwest. Certainly a big flyway for waterfowl, since they can stop almost anywhere for backwaters to rest. Earlier in the program, we talked about the swans that stop over there. They're coming more from the east, as I said, but it is a big resting area for them. And hawks and the songbirds also will migrate up and down the Mississippi River. However, Mississippi Flyway is more than just the river corridor, and it is really a term used in, I think, two different ways. One is that general north-south Midwestern corridor where a lot of birds are flying in spring and fall up and down. It's also used in the waterfowl hunting regulations where we see that a lot of the ducks and geese are moving down the Atlantic and the inland areas up along the Appalachians. That's the Atlantic Flyway, that whole central United States, the Mississippi Flyway. We also have the Central Flyway, which is the grasslands and up to the Rocky Mountains, so just west of us. And then the Pacific Flyway, the birds that are flying along the coastal areas of the Pacific and along the foothills of the Western Mountains. So we essentially divide up some of the hunting regulations within those flyways. So for waterfowl hunting, you want to make sure you survey how many ducks are there. So we know from after the hunting season or midwinter surveys how many ducks remain. We either be doing our spring counts for the number of pairs that are at least intent on nesting. We'll take a look at summer production. And from that, we want to make sure it's a sustainable harvest for those who do hunt, that we don't take more than what's produced each year. And those then are set within those flyways because the birds are flying through those whole portions of the continent, and we want to make sure each state has an equal chance for harvesting some birds without the total being more than at annual production. So these go back way back into the 1930s or so as a natural flyway route migratory corridor for birds, but also for hunting regulations, especially as it relates to waterfowl.
Let's go to Jim in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry, and your guest. Got a question. You've been talking about migrating birds and trying to identify them and feeding birds. On the list, so, the east side of Tosa, we have a family of turkeys, wild turkeys, and you might have heard about them around here. The city took three out a couple months ago in a different family, I think, for the one that wanders through our yard. And we've even stopped putting seed in our feeders because we're afraid they might get too aggressive and might rip up the...
Tear out your bird feeder.
Those talons. Pardon?
Tear out your bird feeders.
Well, we haven't... fed them for quite a while, but I'd like to feed some of the wanderers coming through here now so we get a little diversity. Otherwise, we just have a lot of sparrows and these turkeys. So
okay. Gotcha, Jim. What do you think, Bill?
Well, what I would suggest is turkeys are going to be feeding off the ground and will get up on platform feeders. But if you have more of a tube feeder, something that's, say, like a finch feeder or squirrel-proof feeders, something like that where you've got just a small perch on the outside of a tubular feeder, it's something that a turkey's not going to be able to get on top of very easily. And you can suspend that in some one area. And if you want to do something for the turkeys, you can just throw something on the ground or even put some corn cobs out there and let them pick off of that. And you should be able to find a way to restrict them from access to all of the food.
Yeah, there you go, Jim. And there are some pretty good feeders out there that will keep the squirrels out. They'll also keep the turkeys out, too, for sure. Oh, man, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Beth Ann in Bristol. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
That last caller kind of distracted my imagination, because I remember last fall, and I didn't clear this with Courtney, but I saw three turkey hens, and they each had their own little brood crossing the road. I break for turkey. And where are their husbands, by the way, while they're trying to cross from one cornfield to the next?
Well, turkeys, their mating habits are somewhat like a lot of our ducks, where the males, their main role is to attract the female, to actually then mate for them. They're very colorful in order to be the most successful competitor. But the female raises a young all of her own, especially for waterfowl. They don't want to have that brightly colored male around if they're trying to camouflage. And both of those groups of birds produce what we call precocial young. In other words, the day they hatch, those young are fully feathered and they leave the nest. Unlike our songbirds, where the they essentially hatch out prematurely and are blind, naked, and are raised then within the nest, they require both parents to bring enough food and care for them. What we've got for turkeys is that the hen is really just providing guardianship. She's watching for danger. She's taking them to where there's food and where there's shelter. And so the young are really feeding and pecking on their own. The parents are not, say, deliberately feeding the young, so they don't have to have both parents around.
Hmm. Beth Ann, you had a different question, though.
Yes, I wanted to ask Bill, if because of all the songs, does he believe, or would he research, did birds teach people to sing? I mean, we went from grunt, and now people are singing. So this is a possibility, philosophically, historically, that birds taught men to sing.
Hmm.
I wonder if maybe those weren't just something within the animal world. So many things have different vocalizations, particularly for, say, mating seasons among not just birds, but even mammals. It may be something that's common across a lot of the animal kingdom, but maybe we have picked up a little bit on that music to try to imitate or elaborate or incorporate some of those very exotic sounds that strike our ears.
Yeah, pretty cool question,
good question,
Ben.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in Dubuque, Iowa, on to you.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bill. I'm on the Mississippi River looking out my front window across the river to us, and I see the bluffs of Wisconsin over there. I'm right on the main migratory route. Now, I came up with a feeder about 4 years ago, and the first year I had a couple of Oreos. The next year I had like five or six. The following year I had like 20. And last year, the trees in the backyard looked like a Christmas tree. There were so many of them. And this was Baltimore Oreos. This is after I switched from seed over to oranges and jelly. Now, my question is, does the increase of the Oreos, is it offspring of the previous year, or is it, how does it increase? I mean, how does word spread, I guess?
Okay.
Well, that's a good question. You know, you put out a bird feeder of any type, and if you haven't been feeding for a while, it may take a bit for anything to find it, and then the birds start coming, and of course, it's convenient, so they keep coming. But then the question is, how does that word spread to everybody else? I think a lot of it has to do with decoying in the same way that, you know, duck decoy. Well, it just simply means if you've got a duck out there or even an artificial decoy, it's a visual attractant to birds that realize, well, there must be food there. It's certainly safe. He's not being disturbed. So it looks like a good place to hang out. In a way, it kind of reminds me of watching fishermen out on the lake. You see boats all over the place, and if everybody's moving around, if one guy's still sitting there, it must mean he's catching something. They all seem to kind of congregate to that corner. It's probably the same kind of thing of among these birds that they just happen to see, that there is food. They can hear the other birds. They can see them out there, and this becomes attractive to them. And hey, if it's a good place, why not? You know, everybody joins the crowd.
Yeah. Jeff, thanks. Maybe we've got a Baltimore Oriole sound here, song. Yeah.
There's a lot of variation in that song that they produce, but to me, it's the voice. It's clear, sharper than a robin. It's very upbeat. It seems almost cheerful, and it just has this real caring power to it. So, yeah, it's a bird that I find is easy to find, to locate by the calls and songs.
Kurt from Poinette sent an email regarding the caller about Ricky Ricky. He says, well, up north in Wisconsin, he remembers hearing the teacher, teacher, teacher call of the oven bird.
That's another possibility, another bird that produces that repeated two-note call. And again, you know, here's our problem is that everybody hears it a little bit differently or tried to describe it perhaps differently. What we can describe is the rhythm, but the quality of that song, that vocalization, we can't really imitate these birds very well. And it's just hard, I think, for us to describe it from one person to the next, what you're hearing. That's why recordings are always so nice.
Yeah. And there is an app out now where if you hear you can record the bird's song it'll tell you, or at least try to tell you, what it is.
That is a feature in the Merlin app, and it's a recently new development that they've got added to it. It's a feature. And, yeah, they're basically using that artificial intelligence voice recognition and trying to match it up with the library of different sounds out there.
Well,
so,
if this
keeps evolving, who knows how easy it'll be for some people to identify all those birds out there with just your phone.
Let's hear the oven bird on our way out for the news.
All right. Teacher, teacher, teacher.
There it is. The oven bird. And Bill Volkert will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with Bill. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at birds, bird watching with our guest Bill Volkert today on the show. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Bill's a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for 50 years. So, questions for him? Our lines are all filled now. Here's the number, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Bill, we have Jennifer in Plymouth with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello, Bill and Larry. I have a question about a bird that I think I've seen that doesn't seem to belong to this area. Every winter, of course, we expect the dark-eyed juncos, the slate-colored variety, to come back. But I've seen something that looks like a gray-headed junco, which should be from Arizona in the southwest. It's a medium gray bird with a chestnut spot between its wings. They seem to be the same size. The other juncos do not seem to like them. The two groups seem to argue. And they're only there for about 2 or 3 weeks in the fall, and then they disappear.
Well, and juncos are pretty widespread across the U.S., and there is regional variation. In fact, at one point, biologists actually divided them all up between our slate-colored junco out in the Dakotas, the white-winged junco in the northwest, the Oregon junco. So a lot of these have been split up. Now we simply refer to this as the dark-eyed junco. We lump them all and consider all those just to be regional populations or just variations on the theme of one bigger species. We do know that some of these birds from other parts of the country do wander around in wintertime. Wisconsin, we oftentimes do get individuals of what we call the Oregon junco with the dark head and more brown body. So, yeah, there is some wandering, especially in wintertime, as birds move around. So it's not a real long-distance migrant for the most part, and they seem to not always have a simple migration but move wherever there's food, too. And, of course, with winter storms, some of these birds get blown off course. So, yeah, there's a variation both among the juncos we see for the adult males and the females, which are a little bit lighter gray, and then among regional places, sections of the country.
And we have a junco, I believe, the dark-eyed junco song.
Just a little ringing type chip or chatter. There's a little ring to it, though.
Yeah, you're right.
And our juncos will stick around for about another month in southern Wisconsin, and we'll start to hear them sing a little bit just before they depart. Northern Wisconsin will actually have some nesting up there.
Jennifer, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Terry in Dallas, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. A question about the bluebirds. I and my wife maintain about 12 bluebird houses. Last summer, we had one nesting pair. I knew that they took a hit down south. Wondering when they will return and what the outlook looks like, I guess.
For bluebirds.
Well, yeah, you're down in Texas, and that was...
Well, actually, I think in Dallas, Wisconsin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. different Dallas. Yeah, it was down in Texas where they had ice storms last year, and that really was a significant impact to the wintering bluebirds, eastern phoebes, the hermit thrush. Birds that tend to winter in the southern United States were exposed to that. It's not the cold weather, but it's the fact that the ice storm froze up a lot of the food. Birds got pretty tolerant to cold weather, but they have to eat, and that really hit them hard. But like any of these birds, those that did survive raised families. I know a lot of people were talking about how phoebes were really scarce last year. I was fortunate to have a pair right here by our house. They raised two families. And I think that's pretty typical that a lot of these birds that did survive were successful in raising families and are rebuilding those numbers. So we assume it'll probably take a few years to get back to where we were. But with that, we should start to see a good recovery from that real significant drop in the population from a catastrophic event like that.
Yeah. Terry, thank you. Dave in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Dave.
How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Say, I have on my walks encountered the sound of a bird that I've really never heard around here before. And I guess I'd like to try to recreate it because I was not able to record it. But it's like a trilling kind of, more probably resonant than I'll be able to do, but this is it.
Mm.
Any thoughts?
Is it repeated as rapidly as you're saying, or does it go on real long, one single call, sort of a hollow trill?
Yeah, more hollow, goes on a little longer. I've never been able to.
Yeah.
Why don't you give a listen to the screech owl? He'll do this sort of a screecher whinny, and then this long, hollow, trilled whistle, which is their song. Screech owl is the first one that comes to my mind.
Let's listen to a screech owl. Tyler's got one.
Yep, there's that whinny type call. And then the long, hollow trill.
Yeah. What is it? Is that it, Dave?
That sounds like it's the one.
Yeah, and then that what he was trying to imitate would be the more of the song that the bird does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there you have it, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Still working on Ricky, but we got that one anyway.
Thanks, Dave. Well, Bill in La Crosse, we'll move on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. One comment, the lady that called in from West Salem, I think she was one of the first callers, thought she was seeing swans that were doing circles. Well, we have a high population of pelicans, the white pelican, and they will circle and circle and circle as they gain altitude and then fly off. And they do it.
Yeah, they'll do more soaring. They're using the thermals to get some altitude because that's a big, heavy bird. Of course, pelicans, you've got that black in the wing and a complete different body profile. But, yeah, when they're high up, big white birds like that could be mistaken. Good idea. Yeah, good hint on that one.
Yeah, that's a good one, Bill. And I think we even have a pelican song.
If you want to call it that, right?
Yeah.
I guess that qualifies as a song.
It's a grunt.
Yeah, those are grunts that they'll do at the nesting colonies. And they nest on the ground, usually on islands.
Bill, thank you so much. Daryl in Milwaukee, on to you.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I put up some bluebird houses this year, and I have had some interest in them. But I've also had some sparrows that have been moving in. And I'd like to kick the sparrows out and keep the bluebirds. There a way to do that that really works?
Yeah, that's always a challenge with it. When you put up a nest box like that, it's kind of open for all kinds of takers. My feeling has been, as long as I've got a native bird nesting in it, that's good enough. I enjoy having the tree swallows take advantage as much as the bluebirds. I mentioned earlier the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin website, BRAW. I would recommend to go there, take a close look. And also the call we had just a bit ago about the decline in bluebirds from the winter storms in southern United States. A lot of people register their trails and the nesting success through that organization. And that's a good place where we track a little bit the recovery of the bluebirds across Wisconsin to see the people who manage some of these larger trails, how they're doing and what the recovery is going to be over the next few years as well.
Yeah,
but that's a source I'd say to go to.
Daryl, thanks for calling. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@WPR.org. Don sent us an email about cowbirds. He says that 2 years ago he heard a new bird song, and last year he figured out it was a cowbird, and he really likes that song and loved to hear more about the cowbird.
Yeah, it's got a nice little gurgle-like a song, and they'll do this posturing. The males will bow and flare their tails and feathers out around the female. Sometimes it'll be two, three males around a female. Yeah, the males are certainly attractive birds. The female, just sort of a uniform grayish-brown, which can make them a little hard to identify. They do have a bit of a bad reputation because they are nest parasites by laying their eggs in other birds' nests. But it is a native bird, a member of the blackbird family in Wisconsin or North America. So, yeah, it's a bird that I think more than anything, it's always had this habit of nesting in other birds' nests. But as we've seen the bird respond positively to the land use changes, it has increased. And as it's nesting in other birds' nests that where populations decline, like, say, the wood thrush, for example, it's added pressure on some of those birds that are already under other stresses.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's an interesting bird. And, it is kind of an interesting behavior when you listen and watch them doing their posturing and bowing.
Let's hear the cowbird. Tyler's got it.
A little bubbly, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a little bubbly. It is a pretty song. Well, we got the cowbird taken care of. Let's find out what's on everybody else's mind. Steve and Arena, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a near neighbor to American Players Theater. And anyone that wants to hear whippoorwills can just attend an up-the-hill play at the Players Theater. Most evenings, especially in May, June, well, they aren't in May, but June, July, you're going to hear whippoorwills there. And I have an interesting story that my wife and I were going up from the theater at intermission one night, and this is years ago, and a couple of women, a few people behind us were talking. And one woman said to the other, "I really like the play, but I don't understand why they have that mechanical bird in the soundtrack."
Oh, man. Good story, Steve. About
interesting, too, that where you're located is not far from Dodgeville, where the previous caller also reported them. So, yeah, it seems to be one of the hot spots. So I think people who haven't heard of whippoorwills in a while, maybe a June visit down there, spend a little time in the evening, some of those backcountry roads, or as you said, right by the American Players Theater, and just listen as that sun goes down and hear a bird that really has got just an unusual song.
Thanks, Steve. Jim in Waukesha, on to you now.
Hi, nice to talk to you. I have a question. I have some white-winged crossbills up here in my spruce trees this weekend, and I've never seen them down here before.
Yeah. Remember we talked about the red poles earlier and the invasion of those? That is another bird that also came down this year in some pretty big numbers. They are a real spruce specialist. Those are the cones they go after, and they've got that literally a crossed bill as a way to pry into there for the seeds. And again, it was the same type of thing that Canada had a real poor spruce cone production this past summer, and a lot of them just bailed out and headed down into Wisconsin. So here's a bird that a lot of people were seeing for the first time in a long time, And, yeah, do enjoy them because, like the red poles, they're going to start heading back north to the nesting grounds here in the next few weeks.
And here's, I think Tyler's got their song. Let's listen. Yeah, it's quite a song.
A little bit of a ringing chatter to it.
Yeah.
And that's a bird, if they're going to be nesting, feeding on the spruce cones, is going to be way up overhead in the tops of the trees. So you want to listen for that and then try to find the birds. They can be well hidden in the dense tops of the spruce trees when they're feeding.
Jim, thank you so much.
I know a number of talked about some pretty big flocks that they had a hard time trying to get a view of overhead. That's the way to pick them out first.
Shelley in Sun Prairie, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, Larry, and thank you very much. We have a female cardinal that for all last summer, and now as soon as it warmed up this year, she's back, and she consistently dive bombs a window on the north side of the house, two windows kind of. We've tried everything. We've hung sheets out. We've put up wood. We've got slicks on the window, nothing. When we even put up a sheet outside, she would go around the side and get inside the sheet to peck at the window. And we don't know how to get her to stop. We've shown flashlights. We've made noise. It doesn't matter. She comes right back. She's out there now.
Yeah, that's one of the unfortunate things. It's kind of a conflict like having the robin nesting right by your doorstep as well. It gets to be almost an obsessive behavior with some birds. Cardinals, robins, goldfinches, these are some of the most common ones that do that pecking at the windows. Interesting that a female is doing this. But they can also be somewhat aggressive in claiming a territory as the male is trying to establish one to lure her for nesting. Obviously, they're seeing their own reflection in the glass, and they're trying to keep the competitor out of the neighborhood. And so they get up there, they pound at the glass, they fly away, figure, good, I got rid of him for now. They turn around, and there he's back again. And for some birds, it becomes almost an obsession or an obsessive-compulsive behavior. It's a hard thing to break, and I've had birds do the same thing. The same individual comes back the next year. He's got a bad habit. And as you said, you can cover up one window. They'll go around and find another window. Or also mirrors on cars is another one. I had birds that years past that were finding their own reflection in the mirrors and, of course, leaving droppings all over the side of the vehicle. We had to put plastic bags over the mirrors, which, of course, became a problem because I usually didn't discover that they were there until I'd already driven a couple blocks and realized I couldn't see anything behind me. Yeah, it's what I refer to as shadow boxing. They're seeing themselves and they're fighting that reflection. If you can break them of that habit early on, before it gets ingrained, it's about the only way to do it. But there are some birds, they're out there. You know, we can spend a few minutes before morning, you know, before we head out for the day, and they've got all day. And once it becomes an ingrained, obsessed behavior, it's really hard to break them of it. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. You're going to be kind of stuck with that, and I hate to say it.
A caller from a different show said that they had that issue, and they put a mirror up in a nearby tree. And
give them a distraction? Well, maybe that'll work. It's at least a displacement behavior. They're not going to break the bad habit. They still got the OCD problem, but at least they're taking it somewhere else. So, you might have a solution there to at least give them somewhere else to carry out this unfortunate behavior.
There you go, Shelley. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Bill from Oregon emailed. He wants to know do you know of any cohabitation issues with goldfinches and doves? He added some songbird feeders this winter and had a regular population of 30-plus goldfinches in their pines, but have had very few doves, and they seem to not like areas used by the goldfinches.
I don't know if that is a direct correlation. You know, these birds in wintertime do move around, and some people get some big flocks. Other people notice a bit of a sparse or dearth of birds in their backyard. So there is that concentration of flocks. But I don't think that, say, the concentration of goldfinches is keeping the doves out.
Yeah, probably not.
A direct relationship, yeah.
John sent an email saying he sees robins in the La Crosse Marsh throughout the winter. Are these local birds or migrants from further north enjoying our warm, in quotes, La Crosse winter climate?
Well, good question. We do know there is a migration of the robins coming out of Canada, which is a little bit later than ours. They do have a little bit slight different coloration for the people who have them in the hand. But which ones of those are sticking around? We do know this from our Christmas bird counts that, especially in southern Wisconsin and around areas where there's springs and open water, people will pick up robins almost every single winter in some corner of the state. So 99% of them migrate, but there's always a few that try to stick it out. It sounds like he's got a little bit of an oasis there. Where they came from, whether these are very local birds or others that migrated from somewhere else, that's hard to say.
Lisa,
it's not unusual to have a few robins in a couple little spots in wintertime in southern Wisconsin.
Yep. Lisa has a heated bird bath clamped to the side of her deck. It's used by nuthatches, chickadees, finches, doves, robins, even woodpeckers. When it's very cold out, she has to fill it every day. But the birds poop where they sit around the edge. She rinses before filling and scrapes off any poop. Should she worry about spreading disease?
Yes, always. This is a problem, whether it's a seed that's spilled on the ground or, say, a heated bird bath, is that kind of like a sick kid going into school, you know, he could spread that cold or flu to everybody else in the classroom. The big problem for birds, especially in wintertime, is salmonella, and it's spread through the droppings. So always try to keep your feeding station clean. If you're bringing filling your feeders every couple of weeks, you may want to soak them in warm water with a slight bleach solution, rinse them, and let them dry out completely and fill them then. So keep it clean. Try to clean up the seed that accumulates under your feeder in the wintertime or now in springtime. Rake some of that away. We want to enjoy the birds. We want to lure them in and help them out. We don't want to expose them to any potential disease outbreaks. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Simple thing is keep it clean.
Keep it clean, and that includes the bird bath. The heated bird bath is what she's using. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, Bill, this has been a pure joy. I tell you what, it's been a lot of fun.
Larry.
It's been a lot of fun. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and I will look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Bill.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Larry.
Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. Great to have him with us. He's been watching birds for 50 years, and as you can tell, he knows a heck of a lot about birds. Well, just looking ahead to tomorrow, I've been talking all week about our first book club book of the year. And the author of that book is on tomorrow. Lauren Fox is the author of the book Send for Me. And she'll be on Thursday from 11 to noon here on the Ideas Network. I hope you've had a chance to look at it. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions as we talk with her. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.